reporting, the Supreme Court says immigration agents in L.A. can again stop people based on their apparent race or the language they speak. It comes as President Trump is expanding deportation efforts in Chicago. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Supreme Court ruling came on its emergency docket with no explanation. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Justice Amy Coney Barrett says, quote, sometimes less is more when the justices have less information compared to regular cases. Also, the House Oversight Committee released the letter to Jeffrey Epstein, apparently signed by President Trump, with a drawing of a nude woman and the wish that every day is, quote, another wonderful secret. It's Tuesday, September 9th. On this day in 1850, California was admitted as the 31st state. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Supreme Court is allowing federal immigration agents to continue making random stops of people in Los Angeles. Opponents say this is blatant racial profiling. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor dissented from the opinion, saying no one should be stopped because they look Latino, speak Spanish, and work a low-wage job. The Department of Homeland Security is launching a federal immigration operation in Illinois. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports President Trump has repeatedly threatened to send National Guard troops as well as Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers into Chicago.
DHS is calling it Operation Midway Blitz, saying it's in honor of a woman killed by a drunk driver who was an unauthorized immigrant in Illinois. NPR confirmed that crash took place this year in Urbana. The driver was a Guatemalan national and is facing charges including DUI and reckless homicide. DHS says the operation will target, quote, criminal illegal aliens who flocked to Chicago and Illinois, saying that they went there because they knew Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker's sanctuary policies will protect them. The announcement comes as the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to resume immigration raids in Los Angeles after a lower court judge had blocked them. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Chicago.
The House Oversight Committee has released some documents from the estate of late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Among them is a sexually oriented letter that features a drawing of a naked woman purportedly drawn by President Trump. NPR's Stephen Fowler says the White House says Trump never signed this.
This is a limited set of documents handed over by the Epstein estate. They were answering a subpoena from the House Oversight Committee investigating how the government handled the prosecution of the convicted sex offender who died by suicide in 2019 while in federal custody. There is the copy of a typed letter set inside the drawing of a nude female body that appears to be signed by Trump, which includes the line, "A pal is a wonderful thing. Happy birthday, and may every day be another wonderful secret."
NPR's Stephen Fowler reporting. The government of France has collapsed again. French Prime Minister François Bayrou lost a vote of confidence taken by French lawmakers yesterday. It's over his plans to cut France's huge budget deficit. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports he'll likely resign in coming hours.
The Speaker of the French National Assembly read out the vote on Prime Minister François Bayrou's deficit-cutting plans. 194 for, 364 against. Bayrou said he called the risky vote of confidence because he wanted the parliament behind him and he wanted to alert the French to the gravity of the deficit. Bayrou was President Emmanuel Macron's fourth prime minister in less than 2 years. None has been able to enact his centrist agenda. The far left and far right, who have the biggest blocks in parliament, are now demanding that a new prime minister come from their camps. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
You're listening to NPR News. Several news outlets say the prime minister of Nepal has resigned. This follows intense protests yesterday. Young protesters are furious the Nepalese government temporarily banned social media. That ban has been lifted, but clashes have left at least 19 people dead. The family of billionaire Rupert Murdoch has settled the future of his media empire. Murdoch's son, Lachlan, will remain in charge of the family business. That includes Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Post, among others. Rupert and his son will buy out the company's shares of three other Murdoch children. Preparations are underway for a triple mission to space, taken on a single rocket. Scientists want to focus on space weather, solar winds, and their effects on Earth. NPR's Amy Held reports the mission could launch as soon as 2 weeks from today.
On board a NOAA satellite for forecasting space weather a million miles away. Even space gets storms. The sun spews gas and particles, creating solar wind. That can affect the technology we rely on at home. Nikki Fox with NASA's Science Mission Directorate says the space weather applications are exciting.
But the actual discovery science that we will get from IMAP is going to literally rewrite textbooks, and that's why we're so excited about it.
IMAP, Interstellar Mapping and Acceleration Probe, will study the edge of the heliosphere, the magnetic bubble surrounding our solar system, and how it interacts with the galactic neighborhood. Then there's NASA's first mission dedicated to the exosphere, the last layer of Earth's atmosphere extending maybe beyond the moon. Amy Held, NPR News.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
Continue 0.7 miles, then turn right on Main Street.
For the growing number of people who use GPS navigation to get where they're going, there's nothing unusual about having a computer tell you where to turn. But it hasn't always been that way.
When he first started talking about these systems, people would look at him like he had just invented like a pet rock or something that was just completely and totally useless.
That's Kate Roberts from the Minnesota Historical Society, referring to our very own Bradford Parkinson, born and raised right here in Minnesota.
Bradford Parkinson left Minneapolis and enlisted in the Navy. While he was in the Navy, he wanted to develop a system for the U.S. military so that they could guide missiles to their correct targets. GPS came out of there. But he recognized early on that it would have a lot more applications.
Recalculating.
Now, they're omnipresent. Found in cars, air traffic controllers, everyone relies on GPS.
Which is why Parkinson went on to receive numerous awards for his invention, including the Draper Prize, which is akin to receiving the Nobel Prize in Engineering.
The person who presented it to him said, "We'd like to give this award to people whose inventions will someday be taken for granted."
Arriving at destination.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In a ruling Monday, the Supreme Court cleared the way for ICE and Border Patrol agents to restart aggressive immigration sweeps in the Los Angeles area.
Over the summer, a lower federal court order temporarily put a stop to those sweeps. The judge said there was lots of evidence agents were racially profiling as they roamed the streets, arresting people for possible deportation.
For more on the Supreme Court's decision and the reaction to that decision, we're joined by NPR's Adrian Florido, who is in Los Angeles. Good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
So walk us through this decision.
Well, it was a brief unsigned order granting a request from the Trump administration to lift that lower court judge's restrictions on immigration enforcement raids in the LA area in Southern California. So the government could now immediately resume these aggressive sweeps that it started here in June and that set off protests and clashes in parts of the city and that led President Trump to send in the National Guard. Starting in June, ICE and Border Patrol agents rounded up day laborers in Home Depot parking lots, food cart vendors on street corners, people working on farms or at car washes. And the ACLU sued, saying that agents were targeting people based solely on their skin color or on their accents or on the type of work they were doing. They called it blatant racial profiling. Even U.S. citizens were being arrested. An L.A. federal judge told the government that it could not rely only on race and accent and occupation, and the raids pretty much ended.
So what reasons did the justices give for lifting that federal judge's restrictions?
Well, their order itself didn't give any legal reasoning, but in a concurrence, Justice Brett Kavanaugh cited an estimate that 10% of LA's population is undocumented and said race can be relevant when agents are determining whether they suspect someone is in the country illegally. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote a dissent, and she wrote, quote, "We should not have to live in a country where the government can seize anyone who looks Latino, speaks Spanish, and appears to work a low-wage job." This is a big win for the Trump administration, though, Leila, though it is temporary because the underlying lawsuit is still moving through the courts.
Okay, so what are rights groups, city officials saying in reaction to this?
Mohammed Tajzar, the ACLU's lead attorney in this case, told reporters that the group will continue its court fight to stop these raids.
"We will not stand up for armed, masked goons who come into our neighborhoods, into our streets, and terrorize us.
He said lawyers will keep gathering evidence that immigration agents are employing unconstitutional tactics and arresting people without probable cause or reasonable suspicion that they're in the country illegally. L.A. Mayor Karen Bass called the ruling an attack on the people of Los Angeles, but also on every person in every city in this country.
So this ruling means these aggressive raids will, in fact, resume in L.A. and other cities?
The Trump administration says they will resume in L.A. President Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, and his attorney general, Pam Bondi, both celebrated the ruling. On social media, Bondi wrote, quote, "Now ICE can continue carrying out roving patrols in California without judicial micromanagement," unquote. And the Department of Homeland Security said on social media that it's going to, quote, "flood the zone." This could also embolden the Trump administration as it expands deportation efforts in other cities. Yesterday in Chicago, it announced what it's calling Operation Midway Blitz, and it's possible this ruling will affect that operation. But as I said, Layla, this emergency ruling is not the final word on the underlying lawsuit challenging racial profiling in ICE arrests. There's a court hearing in L.A. later this month, and the case could eventually find its way back up to the high court for a final ruling.
So more legal battles ahead. That's NPR's Adrian Florido in Los Angeles. Thank you for your reporting, Adrian.
Thanks, Layla.
As Adrian mentioned, the Supreme Court's ruling was part of its emergency docket. Shortly before that ruling was released, Justice Amy Coney Barrett defended the court's use of emergency orders in an interview with Sarah Isger of SCOTUS blog. Our co-host Steve Inskeep spoke with Isger about her interview.
For those who don't follow this all the time, what is the emergency docket or shadow docket?
When the Supreme Court decides cases, we're used to them having briefing for a couple months, oral arguments over the course of a few hours, and then we get opinions weeks, sometimes months later. What this emergency docket is that in-between period. What should the law be between now and when that case may be finally decided a year or two later? So it's the interim, the status quo question that the Supreme Court is deciding on this emergency docket.
Which sounds minor, but in the Trump administration this year, there have been a number of emergency docket rulings that would seem to have permanent or near permanent effects, like whether people can be deported right now or not.
That's true. Even the birthright citizenship question, whether someone is a citizen when they are born in the United States, is not really something we think of as simply a status quo question while the case percolates through the courts.
So are these emergency docket rulings then becoming profoundly important, not just a technical or temporary ruling?
Profoundly important is an understatement at this point. It is the main focus of attention on the Supreme Court, especially in this administration when you have a president doing so much through executive orders that are then going up through the emergency docket to decide whether those orders will be in effect while cases are pending or not in effect. This includes whether people that Trump has tried to remove from independent agencies like the Federal Trade Commission or the National Labor Relations Board will stay in their jobs in the interim. As we mentioned, birthright citizenship, deportations, all of these things. What is the status quo while these cases are working their way through the courts?
These are rulings that can be controversial. They often overturn the lower court judge. In many cases, they've been in favor of Trump. And in many cases, they're not explained. Some judges spoke anonymously to NBC and said this puts them in a difficult position. And there's also a judge on the record, Judge Allison Burroughs, who ruled that the Trump administration has illegally withheld money from Harvard University and wrote in a footnote that these emergency rulings, quote, have not been models of clarity, and that lower court judges must grapple both with existing precedent and also guidance from the Supreme Court that appears to set that precedent aside without much explanation. Wow. How is the court, and particularly Amy Coney Barrett, responding to that?
Well, I interviewed Justice Barrett about her new book, Listening to the Law, and I asked her specifically about this emergency docket. How are lower courts supposed to grapple with this? And why isn't the Supreme Court writing as much about their reasoning on these decisions?
We're figuring out how to think about precedent on the emergency docket. And when you write a lot, there is a lock-in effect. One of the drawbacks of the emergency docket is that there's no opportunity for percolation. There's often not opportunity for a lot of reasoned opinions below. So we are in a position where we might be writing sooner than we want to be or with less information than we want to be. So, you know, sometimes less is more.
That, Sarah Isger, is to me a revealing acknowledgement that in many cases, the justices are not yet sure what they think, have not fully reasoned things through, and yet they're making these profound choices.
I think it is very clear that the emergency docket of today is not going to be what it looks like a year from now. I think the Supreme Court justices, this is a multi-member court, 9 people, don't quite know how to deal with all of these new executive order lawsuits coming through. Remember, coming up, we still have tariffs, questions about whether you can fire a governor on the Federal Reserve. All of that will be coming up on the emergency docket here in just the next few weeks.
If the justices have not had time to fully think through the case, could they in some of these instances actually preserve the status quo rather than permitting the president to go ahead and fire someone or permitting the government to go ahead and deport people who would have trouble getting back?
This gets to what it means to have a status quo and what the proper role of the judiciary is. Again, very much up for debate. One version is it should be the status quo before that president came into office. But another version is that this is the politically accountable branch that is only in office for 4 years. And at any time you prevent the government, whether it's state or the president or the federal government, from implementing one of its policies, you are causing irreparable harm to the people's elected branches. And so that's a version of the status quo as well. You saw the Biden administration argue this when it came to the eviction moratorium, student loan debt forgiveness, the vaccine mandate, for instance. All of those also came up in very similar postures.
Sarah Isger is the editor of SCOTUS blog and talked with Justice Amy Coney Barrett for a podcast called Advisory Opinions. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
In other news, the Prime Minister of Nepal resigned this morning, according to the Associated Press and other outlets. This after protesters defied a curfew and breached a government building. Now, the protests are in response to the killing of 19 people Monday and demonstrations partly triggered by people flaunting their wealth online. NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Mumbai with Rajneesh Bhandari in Kathmandu.
Anger was brewing for weeks as youth shared images, hashtag NepoBaby, of the social media lives of Nepal's elites, like the politician's son standing beside a Christmas tree made from Louis Vuitton boxes. The average Nepali makes just over $2,000 a year. They made reels of the images to catchy music. Anger escalated more last week after the government banned most social media, saying the platforms had not registered with authorities. Protests then erupted Monday, apparently called for by students online. Some set fire to branches of political parties, to the home of a former leader. They chanted, "We want our taxes back." Protester Anjal Sritha said he was on the streets.
Because of corruption and because of the ban, we cannot have any freedom of speech.
Activists say security forces opened fire after protesters breached a wall surrounding parliament. One doctor, Sanjay Gautam, described what he saw.
We found the metallic bullets in the thigh, in the leg, in the arm, in the abdomen, in the chest, in the ear. Everywhere.
Meenakshi Ganguly of Human Rights Watch says authorities must be held to account.
These were school children. They were in uniform. For the police to open fire on kids like this is just really, really unacceptable.
The government lifted the social media ban Monday, but protesters say they'll keep going until they see accountability. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai, with Rajneesh Bhandari in Kathmandu.
This is NPR News.
the past, we knew more about our neighbors. I'm Heidi Holton, and KEXC provides that. We get to know the people that live in northern Minnesota, like Kathy Davies on What's for Breakfast.
Well, truly, every day I wake up with you guys, and so there's socialization, and I love the local news. That interview with Amy Klobuchar this morning was wonderful. I am so supportive of finding out what's going on with all the tribal stations, and I care about the Canadian wildfires. I love to hear about everything that's local. You know, I've been to Riverfest, and that was fantastic. I listen to and support KAXE because you guys are what it's all about up here.
When you donate to KEXE, you're supporting your local community. Help us out now during this crisis of the defunding of public media from the federal government. Thank you for being there for KEXE. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
Comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Downton Abbey, the grand finale, concluding the story of the Crawley family. This motion picture event can be experienced in theaters this Friday. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From the University of Maryland Libraries, dedicated to making UMD's research available to everyone and advancing open access for the public good. More at lib.umd.edu. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. The U.S. has laid out a new proposal for a ceasefire in Gaza. President Trump calls it his last warning to Hamas for accepting it. And Israel is warning approximately 1 million Palestinians to leave Gaza City. Now, that's where the military has begun toppling tall buildings. NPR's Daniel Estrin has the latest from Tel Aviv. Daniel, so what is in this U.S. Ceasefire proposal?
We've been speaking with Egyptian, Israeli, and Hamas officials who have shared the basic details. It's not really a proposal. It's more of an outline of ideas. The U.S. is proposing a 60-day ceasefire. And within the first 2 days, Hamas would free all of its Israeli hostages. Israel would free some Palestinian detainees and allow a surge of humanitarian aid into Gaza. President Trump would guarantee both sides would enter negotiations until an agreement is reached toward a final end of the war.
Okay, now we've seen a lot of U.S. ceasefire proposals fail to get anywhere. We've always heard that, oh, it's close. How is this going to be any different?
It may not be any different. I mean, Israel says it's seriously considering President Trump's proposal, but a senior Hamas official has called it a humiliating surrender document. And two Hamas officials tell us that Hamas is studying the offer. They don't want to be blamed for rejecting it. But the basic terms are essentially a non-starter for Hamas. The U.S. is proposing to free that Hamas free all of its hostages at the very beginning and only then to start negotiating the rest of the terms. And that's not good enough for Hamas. It has been keeping the hostages as its number one bargaining chip to get Israel to pull out its forces from Gaza and end the war. So this latest U.S. effort does not look promising, and it's also been eclipsed by some serious violence. Yesterday, six Israelis were killed in a Palestinian shooting attack at a bus stop in Jerusalem. Four Israeli soldiers were killed in Gaza as well, and Israel is intensifying its attacks in Gaza.
I mentioned earlier about the tall buildings. What's been happening there in Gaza?
Well, in recent days, Israel's military has been destroying tall, multi-story buildings in Gaza City. These are office buildings that used to be part of Gaza's commercial hub in Gaza City before the war. Israel's defense minister has been publishing video after video showing tall buildings being bombed and just coming crashing down. So it does bring this kind of symbolic message to Israelis. And one gleaming 12-story building was destroyed in an Israeli strike yesterday. NPR's reporter in Gaza, Anas Baba, filmed the aftermath of that strike. He was caught in a large gray cloud rolling outward, so a huge radius, and people trying to salvage their belongings from a tent camp nearby.
Why is Israel targeting these particular tall buildings?
Israel says Hamas has used these buildings for military purposes, like planting explosives ahead of an Israeli ground invasion. Israel has not published evidence of that, but Israel has given advance warnings, giving people enough time to evacuate. There have been very few fatalities from these bombings, though this morning a Gaza rescue group says it's trying to rescue dozens of people trapped under the rubble of a home in that area. And today, Israel's military has issued a map of Gaza showing all of Gaza City as a danger zone, calling on Palestinians to evacuate to southern Gaza, and most have not fled yet. Many don't think they're going to find room or safety in the crowded south. If soldiers invade Gaza City and masses do flee south, the humanitarian catastrophe there could become worse.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome.
One of the most important things public media does is alert people when there's an emergency, like an approaching hurricane or a wildfire. But public broadcasters say billions of dollars that Congress set aside to upgrade emergency alert systems are in jeopardy after the Trump administration clawed back public media funding, which could leave communities with old infrastructure as they face more extreme weather. NPR's Michael Copley reports, and we'll note that no NPR official or news executive was involved in this story.
When a landslide tore through Wrangell, Alaska a couple years ago, Cindy Sweat says people on the island were nearly cut off from information about the disaster.
There's one road, and everybody that lived south of that road lost everything. They lost their electricity, internet, television, phones.
What was left was the public broadcast from the station Sweat manages.
One guy said, well, I knew KSTK was going to tell me what was happening. And of course, this was after dark, really stormy night. He went and got in his truck and turned on the radio.
Months later, KSTK got a federal grant to reimburse the cost of strengthening that critical alert system. But more than a year after the funding was announced, the station has only spent about half the money. Like other public media executives, Sweat says her project was derailed by stop work orders this year. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting has been administering the program, and it sued the Federal Emergency Management Agency this spring for allegedly withholding grant money. Then Republicans in Congress voted in July to claw back public media funding. Sweat says it left a big hole in her budget, and she couldn't risk spending more on emergency alert equipment without a guarantee of being repaid.
When I think about this on the national scale, that all these rural stations across the United States that were counting on getting this money so that they could, you know, keep citizens safe, and now we're all across the nation unable to do that, it just puts every American in jeopardy.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is winding down its operations and says if FEMA doesn't take over the grant program, more than $96 million won't be disbursed. The White House Office of Management and Budget said the program will continue funding emergency alert infrastructure. In August, FEMA invited states and tribes to apply for $40 million under the program. But with public broadcasters waiting on reimbursements for investments they've already made, they have doubts about the program's future. FEMA wouldn't comment on the record. Sweat says she hasn't heard from the agency.
So I don't know what happens next.
Thousands of miles south in Colorado, Tammy Graham listened with frustration this summer as Congress debated the future of public media. Graham runs KSUT Radio and says she kept hearing misstatements that
everybody can get information anywhere from multiple sources all the time. Well, people that are saying that clearly do not live in rural America.
In parts of the Southwest where KSUT broadcasts, the internet isn't available.
If it is, it's sketchy. It comes and goes.
The same for cell phone service. That's why Graham says the grant funding for public broadcasters was so important.
This is about emergency alerting to, you know, everyone that lives in this region.
She adds that critical function has nothing to do with politics or partisanship. Michael Copley, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The fires that ripped through L.A. earlier this year destroyed thousands of homes, leaving homeowners a choice. Rebuild, relocate, or
thought of moving a house, even a house that's like super beat up. It's like, oh yeah, bring it on.
Why some homeowners are choosing to move homes slated to be demolished rather than build a new home. That's on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered. It's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on KAXE. It's 529. Good morning. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer. We've got our daily dose of nature coming up next. We're looking at a chance of showers and thunderstorms early this morning, then gradually clearing. Highs today 70 to 75 with overnight temperatures 50 to 55 degrees. By Wednesday, we are looking at patchy fog early, mostly cloudy, becoming sunny, high 73 to 76. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. This morning, we would love to hear from you. What nature notes? What things have you been seeing? Birds. We've got crying eagles at our place. Eaglets, I think. Pam Perry's going to be joining us later this morning before 9 o'clock. We'll talk fall birds and migration. But maybe you are seeing the change in plants and flowers and trees right now. We'd love to hear from you. Join us. Text 218-326-1234. It is still early in the school season, so we don't have many student reports yet, so we really want to rely on you this morning. Text 218-326-1234. Today from 11 to 1, Kutaska Community Action is hosting a Big View Conversation. It's at Community Presbyterian Church in Grand Rapids. This month, you can learn more about First Call for Help. They have a mission to provide crisis intervention and referral services. Pre-registration is required. Email AliceM at kutaska.org. Time now for John Latimer and our daily dose of phenology.
On today's date, September 9th in 2003, I noticed that the pin cherries had begun to change color. Pin cherries are an interesting study in color because they get a few red leaves, and then the red leaves fall. Meanwhile, all the rest of the leaves are still green, and then as those red leaves are falling, more leaves will turn red. So you constantly have a mixture of red and green. They always remind me of a sort of a bowl of salsa, because you've got this red and green mixed together, and the red is constantly dropping out, and gradually, over a period of time, you begin to see fewer and fewer leaves on the trees, more and more air between the leaves, and ultimately, you're going to have just a kind of a finish of bright red, and then the tree is going to be bare. So watch the pin cherries, and watch how they go from fully leafed to absolutely without leaves, but watch how they do it going a few red leaves at a time. Never the whole thing all red at once, but a few red leaves, a lot of green leaves, then a few more red leaves, and a few less green leaves until finally the tree will be bare.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Betterment, an automated investing platform that strives to make it easy to be invested. Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts. From the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at VisitSPC.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The House Oversight Committee has released some documents handed over by the estate of Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, that includes more than 200 pages of a book made for the disgraced financier's 50th birthday more than two decades ago. One of those pages is a lewd drawing and letter that appears to be signed by President Trump, a letter that Trump said did not exist.
NPR's Stephen Fowler has read through the document release. Stephen, are these going to be enough to satisfy the demand from people who want the release of the, quote, Epstein files?
Not at all. I mean, this is a limited set of documents handed over by the Epstein estate. They were answering a subpoena from the House Oversight Committee investigating how the government handled the prosecution of the convicted sex offender who died by suicide in 2019 while in federal custody. There is the copy of a typed letter set inside the drawing of a nude female body that appears to be signed by Trump, which includes the line, "A pal is a wonderful thing. Happy birthday, and may every day be another wonderful secret."
Yeah, and I remember this was reported back in July, and now we're seeing the birthday drawing. What else did you see in the documents?
There's a lot of redacted pictures and other vulgar references to Epstein's sex life and personal life, notes from high-profile friends like former President Bill Clinton and lawyer Alan Dershowitz. There was another page that had a mock-up of a check that appears to be a crude joke about Trump and Epstein and a redacted woman. The text below the picture says Epstein was, quote, "showing early talents with money and women, sells fully depreciated," and here's the redacted woman's name, "to Donald Trump for $22,500. There's also a copy of Epstein's will, address book entries, and a non-prosecution agreement by the U.S. Attorney's Office in 2007.
All right, so what are Republicans saying about these documents, including that letter apparently signed by Trump?
In Trump's second term, there's been very little daylight between Republican stances and Trump's often changing views on a lot of things, including Epstein stuff. People like Vice President J.D. Vance, who once agreed with Trump that the files must be released, then agreed with Trump that there were no files, then agreed with Trump that the letter didn't exist, now agree, yet again, with the president that actually it's just all another hoax from the Democrats. Case in point, House Oversight Chair James Comer said in a statement accompanying the release of yesterday's documents that it is, quote, "appalling Democrats on the Oversight Committee are cherry-picking documents and politicizing information received from the Epstein estate."
And Democrats have been talking about the Epstein files a lot, largely because it's politically advantageous to do so. But what's that looking like now?
On the one hand, Trump campaigned on releasing the files. It was part of his campaign message to expose powerful people hiding the truth from the public. It's pretty easy to say he has broken that promise, and now many voters are seeing him as a powerful person hiding the truth from the public. Democrats on the Oversight Committee released the image of Trump's alleged letter, and the White House is insisting that letter actually proves it's not his signature and he didn't actually sign it. Meanwhile, Democrats on the Hill have met with survivors and victims of Epstein's sex trafficking and abuse and are pushing for a fuller release of files for transparency. It's one of the few places where Democrats have leverage against Trump's otherwise complete control of the political narrative in Washington.
All right, that's NPR's Stephen Fowler. Stephen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
For more about the reaction to the release of these Epstein documents, we've got Republican strategist Rena Shaw on the line. She's also a former Republican congressional aide. Good morning and welcome back to the program.
Hello, nice to be with you.
It's good to have you. So I want to start with the big revelation out of these limited release documents, which is this birthday drawing that was first reported back in July. The administration is really coming out denying that this is the president's. What do you make of the administration's approach to this release and that birthday drawing?
Well, this is certainly a bombshell dropped on D.C. because House Democrats releasing this very suggestive 2003 doodle, mm-hmm. allegedly signed by Trump from Epstein's birthday book, has left people saying there is more evidence to show the very tight relationship these two men had. And look, as a former Republican aide, I see that this as a calculated Capitol Hill move to rattle the White House. But what it's done is really distracted from the most important people who are part of this entire unfortunate drama, which are the victims of Jeffrey Epstein. And now when we look at the note's raw details, a naked woman's sketch signed, quote-unquote, Donald, with text about Epstein's, quote-unquote, secrets. Mm-hmm. You know, Democrats are claiming that Trump lied about it. And now his team is calling it fake. So my experience tells me that this is classic Washington, D.C. posturing. But where's the forensic proof to settle this is the question.
Will this release satisfy the base that has been calling for the release of all the documents? And will it change the calculus for some Republicans who are resisting the call for more public releases?
The drip drop of information is not satisfying the base, nor anyone else, particularly not the independents that matter to this administration. We've got midterms coming up not too long from now, and a lot can happen between now and next year, but the rate and the pace at which this continues to plague the White House has got me wondering, at what point do we sort of come up to the 30,000-foot level? Because right now, it's the signature that's sparking debate. You know, Trump is denying the signature, but I've reviewed the 1990s documents there. His Donald scrawl really matches closely. And without hard evidence, this is a beltway standoff. I mean, it's time we focus on the truth, not speculation, again, for the sake of the survivors of Epstein and Maxwell. And then I see the GOP rebels who are leading the charge here. I stand with Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Nancy Mace of South Carolina. They bravely backed a vote as Republicans to release all of the Epstein files. And like people like me are saying, release them all unredacted. They're defying party pressure here. And this week, it was so incredible to hear from Marjorie Taylor Greene when she took to the podium with her colleagues, Democrat Congressman Ro Khanna and Republican Congressman Massey. She said, I ask my Republican colleagues to choose not just one path for justice, accountability, and transparency. I ask my Republican colleagues to choose every path for justice, accountability, and transparency. And if that didn't get to the heart of this administration, I don't know what will. Those were powerful words.
Really quickly, I mean, why not release them all? I mean, the Republican holdouts that are resisting this, if it's going to be popular with the base, why not just do it?
They don't want to do it because they don't want to risk the names that have been there, people who were spotted at Epstein parties, people who have loose connections to Jeffrey Epstein and may have been unaware of the crimes he committed. They don't want those people to be embroiled in scandal.
That's why Republican strategist Rena Shaw. Thank you, Rena.
It's Morning Edition here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Coming up next, we're learning about new scores from 8th and 12th graders that show how U.S. students are doing in science, reading, and math. It is the first release following cuts to the Education Department's research arm earlier this year. Thank you so much for making Grand Rapids River Fest a success. Love to get photos from you of River Fest. You can text 218-326-1234. Now, a message paid for by the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. And that's why there is 988, support that meets you where you are, confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to. You can call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. Our question of the week, as we head into fall, we all kind of want to find something new we might watch. Too many recommendations out there, maybe from people you don't trust. Well, we trust you, and we want to put together a list of favorite TV shows, new or old. You can give us your picks by texting 218-326-1234. Chance of showers and thunderstorms early today, then clearing, high 70 to 77 degrees. Phenology coming up at 7:20.
Well, I've got two brothers and they're in the Marines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled and Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high wear cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance. From filing returns to tracking assessments, learn more at avalara.com/property tax. And from The Economist, in a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, videos, and more at economist.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. New national test scores are out today, measuring 8th graders' science skills, and for 12th graders, it was math and reading. The scores are part of the National Assessment of Educational Progress, also known as the nation's report card, and they come after massive cuts to the U.S. Education Department. It oversees the national assessment, which is required by Congress. NPR education reporter Sequoia Carrillo has been following this. So, Sequoia, what do the new test scores show us?
So these tests were taken in spring of 2024. So this is the first report for these students since the pandemic. And a few things stood out. In 12th grade math, scores dropped about 3 points from pre-pandemic levels, while 8th graders followed a similar pattern with a 4-point average drop in science. These might not sound like huge drops, but I want to note something. In both science and math, drops happened across all achievement levels, so both low and high performing students dropped this cycle. Reading scores also dipped for nearly all 12th graders compared to the last test in 2019. But one important thing to note here is when you compare today's scores to the first nation's report card for 12th grade reading more than 30 years ago, today's average score is 10 points lower. I talked to some of the folks who oversee these tests, and they said this report follows a pattern, one we've known about for a while. Scores from the lowest performing students are at a historic low, and they're continuing on a decline that started more than a decade ago.
Been hearing some Republicans say that Biden policies are to blame for the low scores because the students took these tests during the Biden administration. So how much does federal policy influence what happens in the classroom?
The federal government is not allowed to dictate what is taught in the classrooms at all. So experts avoid linking NAEP scores to any particular administration. Also, these are trends, like I said, that go back several presidential administrations, well before the pandemic. The tests are drawn up by a bipartisan group of local and state education leaders. They include teachers and principals. The assessment is supposed to show people what is happening to students in classrooms, not why it's happening. Nat Malkus is Deputy Director of Education Policy at the conservative-leaning American Enterprise Institute. He explains the role of the U.S. government as somewhat of a scoreboard for the country's education.
The federal government is in a unique position to tell us what's happening and for whom. Just because the federal government is good at being that scoreboard doesn't mean that it has the capacity to fix these issues. That's a job for the states.
Now, back in March, the Education Department cut almost half of its staff. Do we know how all of that impacted the release?
So a senior official at the National Center for Education Statistics, who oversee this test, briefed reporters on condition of anonymity that there are currently only 2 senior staffers left working on the nation's report card. In order to get today's results out, they had to rely on workers from other teams within the department. But that is about to change. The same senior official said they recently received a waiver from the education secretary to hire for 8 more positions being added before the end of the year so that the department can meet its goals in 2026 and 2028 under congressional mandate.
That's NPR Sequoia Carrillo. Thank you for educating us on this report. Sorry for the joke. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
You should give as you are able, because the need is immediate.
longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time, this is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support.
How's that capitalism working for you? Support is slipping for our profit-driven way of life.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need. And by Palo Alto Networks. Palo Alto Networks delivers what's next in cybersecurity innovation to protect today's digital way of life. Learn more at paloaltonetworks.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. American enthusiasm for capitalism is slipping. That's the headline from a new Gallup poll, Marketplace's Savannah Peters reports.
Gallup has been asking Americans how they feel about capitalism and socialism since 2010. Jeffrey Jones runs that survey.
The debate has come up certainly in the last few presidential elections about the economic system that the U.S. has.
And whether it's serving ordinary Americans. In this latest survey, just 54% of respondents said they view capitalism positively, down from 60% the last time Gallup asked in 2021.
And now the gap that we see in terms of positive ratings between capitalism and socialism is the smallest that we've had to date.
That gap is especially small among younger people and Democrats. It's worth noting Gallup doesn't brief people on a shared definition of capitalism or socialism, or ask them about their own understanding. Sarah Damaski teaches those concepts to undergrads at Penn State.
They maybe have a mixed understanding, would be my impression. And I think that it's shaped by how these terms get bandied about in politics.
Regardless, Damaski says capitalism's image problem tells us something important, that fewer Americans feel the economic status quo is working in their favor. I'm Savannah Peters for Marketplace.
After President Trump's firing of the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics that followed job creation numbers that were revised downward, there's a new big revision on the way later this morning. It's an annual thing, but what's not normal is the politicized environment that will surround this data set, which is expected to show the job market is worse than we thought. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
This new BLS report looks at how many jobs were created from April 2024 through March of 2025. Today's revision accounts for businesses that have just opened their doors or closed. It's an effort to update past data on jobs that it gets from surveys of businesses with more comprehensive information from state unemployment insurance tax records that almost all employers are required to file. This could be a big revision. Oxford Economics estimates that up to 900,000 fewer jobs jobs were created from April 2024 through March 2025 than the BLS initially estimated. The new lower numbers could be more fuel for a Federal Reserve interest rate cut later this month. The Fed lowers rates to stimulate the economy, making it easier for businesses to borrow money and create jobs. A number of factors could be behind the slowing labor market. The Fed hasn't cut rates since December of last year. The higher borrowing costs could be contributing to slower job creation. There's also a lot of uncertainty over President Trump's tariffs. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Markets Dow futures are little changed now. Dow and S&P futures are up between a tenth and two-tenths of a percent. A reminder this morning that digging resources out of holes in the ground or scooping them from hills is a massive business. Anglo American and Teck Resources, two vast extractors of natural resources, are combining in the biggest mining merger in more than a decade. The combo will be headquartered in Canada with the new stock called Anglo Teck to be listed in London. There's money in them, though. Our hills and holes. The combined firm will have a market value of $53 billion, about the size of a BMW or a Volkswagen.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by JLL, providing predictive data and insights for real estate investors analyzing and anticipating market cycles. JLL.com. JLL. See a brighter way. And by Baird. Baird strives to attract and retain top financial talent, providing stability and continuity for clients. More at BairdDifference.com.
In the coming days, we'll get more rounds of data on inflation before central banks meet on interest rates starting 1 week from now. Wholesale inflation for what month here? For August comes first, then the consumer price index the day after. The expectation is the Federal Reserve will lower interest rates, but the new data could shape how much and when. Daniel Ackerman has that.
At this point, the market has pretty much priced in a modest rate cut next week. Because when you look around right now,
a lot of signs are pointing to an economy that is slowing.
Celeste Carruthers is a professor of economics at the University of Tennessee. She says one of those slowdown signs is hanging over the job market.
The U.S. has been kind of adding fewer jobs. The unemployment rate is historically very low still, but it has been ticking up over a number of years.
A rate cut could help reverse those trends. But remember, says Stephen Cicchetti, a finance professor at Brandeis University,
the Federal Reserve have a dual mandate.
That mandate is to manage not just the job market, but also inflation, which, thanks in part to tariffs, remains hotter than the Fed's target of 2%.
It's no mystery to anyone who does food shopping, for instance, that food prices have gone up. It's not a mystery to people who have to pay home energy prices. Electricity prices have gone up.
And even though a rate cut could push those prices even higher, Cicchetti says the Fed's concerns about the job market are beginning to outweigh its worries about inflation. The consumer price index rose at an annual rate of 2.7% in July. It would take a huge jump in the August data for the Fed to hold interest rates steady, says Vivi Chari, an economist at the University of Minnesota.
They saw something like 3.5%, 4% inflation in the CPI and the PPI. That might raise alarm bells.
But he says that's unlikely and agrees that the economy is probably in line for a rate cut. That doesn't make it an easy decision for the Fed, though. Patrick Harker is former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, now at the Wharton School, and he sees some echoes of the past.
It's not the 1970s, but it does feel like stagflation-y. I'll use a technical phrase.
I couldn't find stagflation-y in the econ textbooks, but Harker says, like in the 1970s, there are two problems here.
The trends are clearly for a softening economy and for inflation to remain sticky.
Which means using interest rates to address one of those problems could make the other worse. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
Our producers are Tamar Fagan, Ariana Rosas, and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Alex Schroeder. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
Coming up, news headlines from National Public Radio here on 91.7 KAXE, Grand Rapids 90.5, KBXE, Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. People-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Find more and join us at KAXE.com.
Org. You're going to want to take a look at our website and do that frequently because we've always got new news, more news there, including our top story from Charlie Mitchell, oak trees providing acorn utopia to hungry woodland wildlife. We've also got a story about DNR recognizing three Northland COs for life-saving efforts in 2025.